welcome to Radio Taboole, fresh content west of the Middle East, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Levantine Cultural Center. Based in Los Angeles, the center promotes a greater understanding of the Middle East and North Africa with artistic and educational programs that bridge political and religious divides. This week's podcast features a panel discussion and lecture series on Middle Eastern comedy, sponsored by Levantine Cultural Center and the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. The talk took place in the context of West Meets East, the inauguration tour of the Sultans of Satire. It was on the occasion of President Obama's first days in office. The conversation explores the landscape of American Middle Eastern ethnic comedy and its intricate relationship with Islamophobia. It was co-sponsored by the University of Pennsylvania Jewish Studies, the South Asia Center, and African Studies. Panel members included Mukahit Balichi, professor of sociology at John Jay College, CUNY, Jordan El-Grabli, founder of Levantine Cultural Center and the Sultan of Satire Middle East Comic Relief, and Dr. Rahim Armat of Kudum Cultural Events Search Engine, also featuring the Sultans of Satire with Mike Bataya, Elham Jazab, and Noel El-Grabli, speaking before their shows in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. The panel took place on January 16, 2009 at the University of Pennsylvania.
Today I'm going to talk about the emergent Muslim ethnic comedy in the United States. The association of Muslims with terrorism after 9/11 has prompted a search for the comic side of being Muslim. Do these people ever laugh? People usually ask. The simplistic idea that Muslims hate us has simultaneously produced rigid stereotypes about Middle Eastern people and a countering desire to discover what those stereotypes deny, namely a Muslim sense of humor, among other things. Needless to say, in reasoning like this, humor usually stands for humanity. If someone has a sense of humor, if they can laugh, then they are human, they are likable, they are like us. There were two instances in the aftermath of 9/11 that revolved around the relationship between Muslims and comedy. The first one is a movie, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Basically, there is a struggling Jewish American comedian who is sent by the government to the Muslim world to discover what makes Muslim laugh. Strangely enough, he goes to India and Pakistan, you know, not central places for what is imagined to be Muslim world. But basically, he finds out that Muslims are a bit dangerous, Pakistanis in this case, and yet more authentic, more funny compared to their Indian friends. This was a movie that kind of pointed to this tension between being Muslim and having sense of humor. The second one is the famous Danish cartoon Crisis, which shone an uncomfortable spotlight on the Muslim relationship to humor. Rather predictably, some Western commentators saw in the Danish cartoon affair a Muslim intolerance of humor, which a lot of people equated with cultural inferiority. So increasing curiosity about Muslims and their supposed lack of humor has created a surprising demand for Muslim ethnic comedy, especially in liberal societies where Muslims have the relative comfort to crack jokes about themselves and their non-Muslim compatriots. Since the tragic events of 9/11, therefore, there has been an upsurge of Muslim comedy by Middle Easterns and South Asian Muslims in the United States. Individuals and groups such as Allah Made Me Funny and Access of Evil are appearing on stage with comic routines. Paradoxically, a tragedy that triggered widespread Islamophobia, that is the fear of Islam, in American society seems also to have opened the space for Muslim comedy. I would like to argue that Muslim ethnic comedy in the US is a series of inversions played out against a background of Islamophobia. We owe Muslim comedy in part to Islamophobia. A journey from fear to laughter, it aims to bridge, that is, Muslim comedy, aims to bridge the divide that separates Muslims from the rest of American society by reaffirming their common humanity. Now, Muslim comedy is an emerging market. Not only is its audience growing, it is also a new career field for Muslim cultural entrepreneurs, mostly second-generation young people and converts. The time is right, says Zarkan Nawaz, the Muslim producer of Little Mosque on the Prairie. "The marketplace has never been this curious about Muslims," she says. "As cultural entrepreneurs, people like Nawaz claim knowledge of both worlds, ethnic and mainstream. This is best illustrated in their ability to go back and forth between, say, accented language and regular speech. This position is often a tragic one, where a person belongs to both worlds and neither. The comic stands uneasily on a fault line. Yet by standing there, he becomes a sort of stitch that holds together the two sides of the cultural rift. Muslim comedy did not begin with 9/11, but it did take on a distinctive form and quality after it. 9/11 is a turning point in the history of American Muslim ethnicity, but also it is crucial in the history of American Muslim comedy. Like every other ethnic group, the various Muslim communities had their own internal humor, their own comedians, but they were completely obscure from the point of view of larger society. They lacked both common language with the wit and the reputation among mainstream audiences. The members of comedy troupes such as Allah Made Me Funny and Access of Evil were comedians, but they were not American Muslim comedians. They were either obscure ethnic comedians or generic mainstream ones. For example, before his Allah Made Me Funny days, Preacher Mas was producing primarily, but not exclusively, African-American humor. Writing for George Lopez and Daryl Hammond, he was a mainstream comedian with an African-American edge. As an individual, he was Muslim. But this wasn't the primary framework defining his work before 9/11. Similarly, Dean Obidala of Access of Evil repeatedly says that before 9/11, he was a white guy doing generic comedy. And after 9/11, he lost his white status and became an Arab-American comedian. Now, Islamophobia is, as I said, what has made Muslim comedy a phenomenon of our times. The discrimination, prejudices, and stereotypes from which Muslims, other Muslims suffer are a godsend for the Muslim comedian. In a sense, Muslim comics represent the experience of most Muslims, but in an inverted way. They are perhaps the only beneficiaries of the negative charisma associated with being Muslim. You are either attracted to the charismatic or you are afraid of it. So the image of Muslim as a potential terrorist creates a wave of fear which turns Muslim into a charismatic entity. Now, I would like to show you a couple of clips.
This is a special presentation of America at a crossroads.
Everyone feels a little bit like me walking into the airport. Heads turned simultaneously. Security goes, we got my arm at 4 o'clock. Imagine what it feels like when I get on the plane. People are in shock. I mean, they're in the middle of conversations. You're like, someone, where are you from? I don't really understand what they're so scared of. I don't understand, because think about it. If I was a crazy Muslim fundamentalist terrorist about to hijack the plane, this is probably not the disguise I would go with.
Some of you might know who I am, and some of you might not. For those of you that don't know who I am, my name really is Ahmed Ahmed. And I can't fly anywhere. You guys got so bad, now I just went to the airport in G-Stream. My very guys are sitting, true story, I'm sitting on the plane flying United Airlines. And they pulled me off the plane. I had my seatbelt on, the engines were already going. I thought we were like on our way. Somebody from the ticket counter comes up to me like, "Mr. Ahmed,
you were dead.
We have some questions we want to ask you. You can't pull it off the plane." I can fly because I know what's going on in the world. I take out my seatbelt. I'm getting out of my seat. The two white guys sitting next to me were like,
Did you get the last joke? Oh, Orange Alert. All other communities have their special weeks, days of remembrance. And what do Muslim Americans get, or you know, Middle Eastern Americans get? All they get is Orange Alert, it says. Now, you saw some of the clips from both Access of Evil and Allah Made Me Funny. Now, their routine about, mostly revolve around issues of airport security. And what I showed first, Azhar Usman's performance, is a perfect illustration of Muslim airport experience, where the negative charisma of being Muslim assumes full transparency. At the airport, those who have so far, in the city, at the ticket counter, etc., has been treated equally, suddenly become suspect. At the internal borders of the nation, they suddenly feel their protected status begin to evaporate. Even those Muslims who do not consider themselves particularly profiled or discriminated against in everyday life suddenly begin to feel uneasy. Strip search and other security rites of passage through the border show them the hard edge of the nation. You feel American sovereignty at the edges, at the borders of the nation. Here, Muslim otherness is revealed in its most conspicuous way. Despite official efforts to present searches at the airport as random, comedians like Obidallah skeptically ask their audiences, "Are you selected for random search even when you are dropping a friend off at the airport?" he says. The fear a Muslim inspires is associated with the unpredictability of his behavior. I mean, it's the unpredictability that inspires fear. What if he is a terrorist? What if he hijacks a plane? What if he is only pretending to be normal? All these questions that airport authorities ask citizens to consider transform the Muslim passenger, in the eyes of his fellow travelers, into a source of unpredictability and danger. And this is the heart of definition of charisma. To be unpredictable is what makes you charismatic. There is nothing spiritual or mystical about charisma, actually. So the anxiety ends. The rest of Azhar Usman's performance tells us about this. The anxiety ends only when the plane lands. People are almost thankful to the Muslim passenger for not doing what they feared he might. Flying while Muslim therefore becomes an extremely public event. All the passengers fly with the Muslim. They feel that tension. A crucial point here is that the airport is where Muslim experience and American mainstream experience meet. Jokes about aviation thus have a remarkable degree of transparency and universality. In other words, when Muslim comedians share their jokes about airports and airport security, everybody laughs, understands those jokes, because it's transparent to regular American as well as to ethnic Muslim or Middle Eastern people. These jokes, in a sense, represent the comic surface where Muslim and American perspective intersect most dangerously, so to say. The Access of Evil comedy tour started in November 2005 and gained national recognition with an appearance on Comedy Central in 2007. The group also put out a DVD in 2007, which features Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, Aaron Kader, and their guest member, Dean Obidallah. Now, the appearance and potential disappearance of ethnic comedy is linked to the location of an ethnic group, their location in relation to the majority society. Which ethnic groups are famous for their jokes? Right? Jews? Who else?
Blacks.
Blacks.
Rednecks.
Increasingly, redneck. The moment redneck moved away from being majority culture to minority culture, because against the Yankee, redneck can exist. So you have to be a minority to become the source of jokes. Anxiety about identity preservation and the power differential with the majority group can combine to create a sense of insecurity. So the groups that have sense of insecurity are more likely to crack jokes. This insecurity, a mismatch between habitus and habitat, to use sociologist Pierre Bourdieu's terms, produces cultural discord and can lead to tragic and comic outcomes. In this sense, both fear and laughter are reaction to otherness. When you see something strange, you either find it amusing, funny, or you feel fear. they represent, both fear and laughter, represent two directions of destabilization and alienation from everyday rationality. When something familiar, something that we all share, we are familiar with, it doesn't attract our attention. We don't turn towards something that is, you know, regularly sitting there. But if something is falling, something unpredictable, that generates interest. No wonder, then, that people who experience shocks, from accidents to earthquakes, are prone to laughter. There are studies about people who have experienced earthquakes, for example, famous San Francisco earthquake. Those people were laughing at the slightest provocation. You know, you touch them, they start to laugh. After a shock, you have an accident or something, you are likely to laugh. Okay, you become very sensitive to laughter. For this same reason, you are likely to cry as well. And these two kind of edges, these two ends of, they represent the two directions towards which one can depart as you move away from the common and shared rationality of everyday life. Now, discrimination or racism and ethnic comedy are the two sides of the same coin. That's the argument I would like to make. In both cases, there is a breakdown, or more precisely, a deroutinization. A certain degree of alienation from common sense. And when I say common sense here, I refer to a social consensus, a shared vision. The majority knows only its own view of the world. And from its vantage point, the minority may look funny. But the minority has access to two points of views, two visions. The majority vision, which it is obligated to cultivate in order to fit in, and its own particular view. The group with the double vision, the minority, is more likely to see incongruities between the two worldviews, and so finds more to laugh at. It is no wonder that many minority groups are historically famous for their humor. Behind the large body of Jewish humor lies the Jewish experience of marginality. Minorities, in our case immigrant communities, can laugh both at the majority's taken for granted idiosyncrasies and at the majority's view of the minority, which they find scarily wrong or amusingly incorrect. Now, anthropologist Mary Douglas has rightly called humor a play upon forms. The ethnic comedian basically plays on stereotypes. He critiques and destabilizes the existing common sense for its failure to see reality. It comes as no surprise that Aristotle declares in his Poetics that the comic poet should assign his characters their ancestral dialect and himself the local one. So there should be two styles, two worldviews. And the discrepancy between them is what generates laughter. Okay. The comic vision reveals a reality that is different from the common sense reality. And now, there has been various theories that people have developed to explain humor or laughter. Why do we laugh? Okay. And one of the oldest ones is called superiority theory. And this approach is held by Hobbes and by Plato and Aristotle. And the idea is that we laugh at people who are inferior to us. Laughter is a product of sense of superiority over others. Now, this is, in a sense, a political explanation of humor. If we are more powerful, stronger than other people, we find people funny. If this superiority theory is a political explanation of the comic, then incongruity theory, that's another alternative, provides a cultural one. It argues that humor is an outcome of inconsistent, unexpected acts and conditions. For example, Pascal argues that nothing produces laughter more than a surprising disproportion between that which one expects and that which one sees. You expect something, you see something. That discrepancy is the source of laughter. Or we have a certain conception, we have a concept of something, and there's a particular case, the case doesn't fit, it becomes a source of humor. Now, another prominent theory, in addition to superiority and incongruity theories, is relief theory. This is a psychoanalytical approach, most famously associated with Freud. Relief theory emphasizes the cathartic release from repression. in civilization and its discontents. Freud explores the psychic cost of civilization for individuals. Basically, he sees a tension between pleasure principle and reality principle, that we want a lot of things, but social life, reality blocks us from this. So there's a kind of gap there, and a certain repression, which he considers to be the main source of unhappiness of modern man, source of our stress and so on. Now, in comedy, the relationship is reversed. The relationship between reality principle and pleasure principle is reversed. We revert to the pleasure principle, although temporarily. Mary Douglas and Victor Turner, two prominent cultural anthropologists working within the Durkheimian tradition, rightly point to the margins and liminality as the location of humor. Humor happens at the edges of mainstream, for example, where mainstream and the minority meet each other. Comedy, they claim, turns the world upside down by showing the audience the view from the other side. When you watch all these ethnic stand-up comedians, you have access to the perspective from their side, right, point of view. They become the best translators of the experience of the minority for the majority. Now, the majority's vision is temporarily and imaginarily relegated to the status of anti-structure, while the minority's vision, which is the anti-structure, is elevated in its place. In this reversal of symbolic order, the minority is released from social classifications, that is, from stereotypes, and the majority is given the opportunity to feel like the minority. When comedians perform, they can crack jokes about anything. It's infinite freedom, almost, they have. And that is a sense of release from the existing limitations of stereotypes, of common sense, of rationality, and so on. Now, the idea of reversal of symbolic order is very important, and people like Mikhail Bakhtin have talked about that, how festivals, carnivals are moments where the world is turned upside down. And Nietzsche described two forces, two principles that are in action in our lives. One is Apollonian, the other is Dionysian. The former is associated with structure, with rationality, with seriousness. We are Apollonian when we talk seriously, okay, when we use our reason rather than our emotions. And the latter, the Dionysian, is associated with emotions and laughter. Both comedy and tragedy originated in the cult of Dionysus, the Greek god of revelry and excess, who violates all ordinary boundaries. Dionysian is the canceling of the reason, that where emotions are set free completely. That's why comedy is perceived as a threat to the established order. Repressive regimes don't like comedians. They don't like humor because they perceive it as a threat. Similarly, Plato in his famous Republic famously calls for the banishment of poets from the ideal city. In Greek times, comedians and tragedians were called poets. They were considered as poets. Now, in one episode of The Little Mask on the Prairie, we have an interesting moment I would like to tell you about it. We have Bobber, who is a protective father and who is reluctant to let his daughter dress up and go trick-or-treating at Halloween. He finally decides to let her go. She insists his daughter wants to go to trick-or-treating. And he finally lets her go, but only if he goes with her. So the little girl in her costume sets out with her bearded father in the religiously conservative Pakistani dress that he wears every day. But the neighborhood children greet him with shouts, "Great costume," they say, when they see him in his Pakistani dress. They think he has dressed up as Osama bin Laden. In a carnivalesque moment, the festivity that Bobber had thought was foreign to his culture and potentially harmful for his children suddenly turns around and embraces him. By a cultural accident, an awkward-looking immigrant guy becomes a local dressed strangely for Halloween. And for once, he feels comfortable in his exotic outfit. He doesn't feel like a minority at the moment of Halloween. And joins his daughter in playful celebration of Halloween. And he says, Halloween became Halloween. You know, it's a halal holiday now. He almost reverts to the unself-conscious pleasures of childhood, horsing around with the other kids and competing to see who can get the most candy. For a brief time, the abnormal exotic has become the normal familiar. He feels relieved. Now, an interesting development has been FBI's attempt to reach out to Middle Eastern American communities. And they actually hosted members of Axis of Evil, people like Ahmed Ahmed, to perform for their Arab American audiences, because people are reluctant to join FBI and FBI wants to incorporate at least, or they want to do some PR. So ethnic comedy becomes an instrument for both for the government to reach out to the Muslim community, and it's also an instrument for Muslim comedians to reach out to the mainstream American society. In a sense, comedy plays a crucial role in cultivating a linkage between the mainstream and the minority to undo the alienation and kind of re-establish the humanity of the Muslims.
What interests me is the convergence of cultures, and in fact, we started Levantine Cultural Center before 9/11 in order to create a dialogue of cultures and a dialogue of the religions of the Middle East and North Africa. Every country in the Middle East is a little cornucopia of several religions and cultures and dialects. I think there's like 26 different dialects in Iran. In Morocco, you have the Berbers, the Spanish, the Muslims, the Jews, the Christians, and this is played out in all of the countries. Turkey's a very diverse population as well. Normally the word Levant refers to the Eastern Mediterranean countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Jordan, Egypt, Israel. But we use it in a broader sense to sort of encompass this entire, you know, Muslim slash Middle Eastern world and the diaspora. As far as the comedy goes, you have to remember that all of these comedians that we're talking about in the United States, they're Americans and they're Middle Eastern. They're sort of between cultures, as Professor Bilici mentioned. But before 9/11, they were Americans first, and Jordanian or Persian or what have you second. After 9/11, I think that flipped, and suddenly their ethnic identity, their religious identity was highlighted. And in some cases, the reaction was that they wanted to hide it, you know, similarly to what happened after the revolution in Iran in 1979. I remember I was a student in the D.C. area in those days, and we used to march with the Iranian students against the Shah and the Savak and all that. And then after the hostages were taken, suddenly the Iranians disappeared and they started calling themselves Tony and said they were Italian. But what's fascinating about cultures is the way that you can be a cultural commuter. And like in our family, on my father's side, we are Berbers, that is the natives of North Africa, intermarried with Jews, and some of the family had converted to Islam a couple hundred years ago. So all the El Grablis in Fez are Muslims, and the El Grablis in Casablanca are Jews, and the El Grablis in Taradan, which is near Marrakesh, are Berber, and they're a mix. Kind of an alliance of civilizations rather than a clash of civilizations. We don't believe in that. You know, whether you're Muslim or Jewish or Christian, if you have a parent or a grandparent from the Middle East, there's a good chance that you'll have a lot of things in common. I mean, look at right now, the Israelis and the Lebanese are fighting over who actually owns the rights to falafel. But they both eat it, and they have that in common. So these comedians were all Americans first, and as you mentioned earlier, they're the ones that that speak out, that are sort of uncensored, or they would like to be uncensored. And you know, the big watermark in our culture here was in the 50s. Lenny Bruce was a comedian who he cursed, he said whatever he wanted, and he was actually jailed several times for being pornographic, for using words, you know, the human anatomy and various sorts of insults. And he broke down the barriers of race because he would talk to the audience and he would use these epithets. He just wanted to show people the power of words and also the limitations. And he would say, "I got any kikes in the audience, any niggers, any wops, any chinks?" He'd use all of these derogatory words, and at first people would be shocked and offended. And they would turn around and realize, oh, well, we're all, you know, and so it produced the shock, and then this kind of bonding happened with these cultures and he had a strong following for a long time. But then he kept getting arrested. The authorities wanted to shut him down so badly that they put him in jail, you know, so many times, and he became obsessed with his court cases and lost track of the humor, and he kind of burned out that way. But Lenny Bruce influenced a whole generation of people to come after him, like George Carlin and Richard Pryor, and those comedians are basically the fathers of the comedians that we've been seeing today. All the Acts of Evil guys and the Sultan of Satire guys, maybe to a lesser extent the people in England. I would rather be kind of a moderator in this discussion rather than take up more time up here. Especially interested in the questions, and I'd like to invite the comedians who are here up, and we can have a dialogue. Elham, do you want to? I know you're an actor and you studied drama and all that. How did you get into comedy?
I did study theater and film in Chicago, and I'm Persian. I come from a medical family. So, you know, basically, if you say you want to be an actress, you're saying you want to be a prostitute. Not saying that's what I wanted, but the culture looks at it that way. So in Middle Eastern culture, particularly among Iranians, where status is such a big deal, going into medicine.
Or engineering.
And then but medicine's here, and then engineering, and then everything kind of falls down here, and then actress doesn't even show up on it. But it was when I was married before, and when I was going through my divorce, I started doing one-woman shows, which was more like performance art, we called it at that time, with different characters. And then I started gearing it more about being Persian, being Middle Eastern. That was before 9/11. And I had planned on moving to Los Angeles because I was so sick of shoveling snow in Chicago after being there for 16 years. Not that I don't like this weather. It's actually like natural Botox. You walk out there and your face freezes, but then you can't feel anything else. Well, I moved to Los Angeles to California right after 9/11, and then to LA a year later, and then I started doing my stand-up in the clubs and so on and so forth. And then I got branded as a Persian comedian. I wasn't necessarily looking to do that, it just happened, because it's very unusual to have a Middle Eastern girl, an Iranian, to get up on stage and to talk about jokes. And in LA, most people think I'm Mexican anyway. Particularly the Persians. They say, you're Persian? I didn't know you were Persian. I thought you were, they want to say Mexican, but they say Spanish, because they say maybe I want to be European. I thought you were Spanish. And then, you know, I'm like, no, I'm Persian. They really speak Persian? And so I'll say some words in Farsi, and they're like, oh, look, your accent is so cute. Yeah, well, so's yours. So that's kind of how I started. And then I met Jordan about 3 years ago, and since then, been working with Sultans of Satire.
You said that a lot of people recognize that you're Persian and they wanted you because of that. Do you guys ever resist, or do you ever feel like you wanted to resist that stereotype? Like, well, this is what you are, can you do comedy about it? Do you ever feel like, well, I don't really want to?
Comedy is comedy. I used to say this to me and Noah, had a discussion about this. I was like, you know, funny is funny. It's all about your delivery. You can camouflage a political statement in one of your routines. As long as it's funny, you can say things about people. I've been in rooms where I'm making fun of a Jewish person sitting right next to a Muslim person, making fun of a Muslim person sitting next to a Jewish person, and they're cracking up. It's something amazing happens, whether you believe in God or not. You have to admit something. Something spiritual happens when you're in a room, you have all these minorities in one audience, and everybody becomes one. Then the amazing thing happens, the lights come on, you go outside, and right away that animosity comes back. Something happens magical in that room. Laughter alleviates something. You can't break it down scholastically, you can't break it down medically, scientifically, you can't explain it. That's the beauty of it. That's what I feel when I'm on stage. It's such a beautiful thing that happens. And you feel it when you're in the audience as well, too. When you're part of the audience, you feel it.
I think one thing that's interesting is that I think we all consider ourselves Americans, and we don't have an accent when we speak. So a lot of people don't know until you get up and you define yourself. And I've had people come up who've been at my shows, and they're laughing. Well, that must be really limiting, you know, you being Middle Eastern. I'm like, you were laughing. You were here, you were laughing at the jokes. What was the difference?
And I didn't get into the Middle East. Like I said, I didn't even know there was a Middle Eastern movement happening.
But it's just, it's it's actually a very good venue, and you'll see more and more people taking advantage of the fact that they're Middle Eastern now, where we were kind of like the pioneers.
Dino Badella says this. He goes, well, I'd like to thank 9/11 for giving me a career. You know, which is it's funny and it's heartbreaking at the same time. I didn't even know there was a Middle Eastern movement happening in comedy. When Aaron Cater turned me onto it, he saw me perform somewhere. He's like, dude, you're Arabic? I was like, yeah. Oh, we're doing this thing. You gotta come. I was like, oh, and he introduced me to Jordan, who introduced me to Maz and Ahmed, and I got plugged in that way. Now I'm performing overseas. I'm going to Dubai February 7th. I've been to Jordan, and the amazing thing is people are like, well, how do they respond? They are so hip. They're hip. They're fun. They get every reference, Western and otherwise. And yes, it's not a niche, and you don't have to go up there and do all Middle Eastern stuff. I was talking about Obama. I was talking about relationships in America. And people were just on it. You know, Ted Alexander. There was next year, Dave Chappelle's coming down there, and they love these comedians. You know,
interesting outcome of 9/11 has been, it's a twofold outcome for Middle Easterners and Muslims in general. It created exclusion, and at the same time recognition, because you are excluded, it and gives you recognition as well.
Yeah.
So increased visibility of Muslims created this niche actually. And, so comedians are walking. There is a spotlight, whether it is for surveillance or, you know, for other purposes.
And he touched on something earlier too. If you think about every minority group that's really made leaps and bounds into the mainstream, they've had activists. Black people had Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. But if you really think about it, Richard Pryor has done more for the black movement than anybody, because he was up on stage at a time and people didn't know about pimps and whores and those areas if you're white bred, but he brought that into the mainstream. You see what I'm saying? So he did more to break the stereotype than anybody. The Mexicans, the Puerto Ricans, they had Freddie Prinze, they have George Lopez to look at, and it makes them more acceptable. So I think our time is coming, whether it be Arabs or Muslims. Humor is the key element to really push open the doors fully. You know what I mean?
It's a way to break the stereotype too. Because, for instance, like I grew up here on the East Coast. I grew up in near Washington D.C., but in Virginia, and I grew up with a lot of redneck buddies. So I was kind of like an undercover redneck when I moved to L.A.
Yeah.
So I'm Middle Eastern, and at the same time I'm Arab and Jewish, and like a redneck. So it was like, you know, completely defies every stereotype. So when me and Mike did the New York Arab American Comedy Festival, I was like the only Jewish guy who was also Arab, and then I felt like the one white guy at the black comedy show. You know, I was like, it was almost a weird experience.
And people talk about, oh, there's racism, there's not. And I go, you know, the funny thing is, and my black friends would complain, man, there's still racism out there, man, they still hold me down. You know, I'm like, really? Now imagine me. I look Puerto Rican. I don't really look Arabic, especially when I shave. So I'm there listening to what people are saying about my people in front of me, to me. And I'm like, yeah, those Arabs, And I'm just biting my tongue. Should I punch him in the face? Should I just walk away or just let it sit? And it's a very unusual way to go through life. And it's interesting. You have to laugh it off or else you're going to go nuts.
Tell us about your feeling born after the first show.
When I started doing more Middle Eastern material, you mean? It was liberating and nervousness, too, especially when I was doing it in front of mixed crowds. Like, okay, are they going to, because I'll talk about my family and... And I'm like, are they going to get it? And ironically, they were laughing the hardest. I mean, it's like you're making friends, telling them your perspective on your culture and what happens in your neck of the woods and they've never been in. You know what I mean? And you're inviting them in.
Like speed dating. You're going up there and trying to tell them
speed
about
dating.
You know, yourself in like 7, 10, 15, 20, 40 minutes or whatever. So sometimes they get it. Sometimes they can build a rapport with you and you can explain jokes and things about your background and get some sort of, you know, contextual foundation. Sometimes you can't, you know. So sometimes you sort of go out there and you tell them about yourself. It's like Mike and I just did a show the other day at a synagogue.
That was my first time. I wasn't supposed to go, but I was like, you know what? Can I open up for you? I just wanna say I did a synagogue. I just wanna say I did it, you know. And I went on stage and I put the yarmulke on and I was like, this is, I'm not, you know, out of respect. I'm just trying to cover my bald spot. And they laughed, you know. It's weird. You know, people will tell you backstage, don't say this. And when I went to Dubai, they were like, oh, we love your stuff. I was like, okay. Right when I got on stage, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, don't talk about this, don't talk about that. Go out there and be funny. I'm like, what do I talk about? The weather? And these promoters were the ones that were stick up their butt. Because when I went out there, I was like, you know what? I'm here. I'm gonna give them what they want. You know, you cannot be their parent. You know, the guy cannot, they don't want to hear, they're grown people. I went out there and did it. They were laughing. I was like, okay, I'm going to go a little further. You don't know where the line is until you cross it.
It's not just cultural stereotypes, too. Like, I know Hong Kong's up against the gender stereotype, too.
Yeah.
Some people will be like, oh, there's a Persian female comedian, and she really a female? And she funny? I'm like, yeah, she's hilarious. And they see her, and they like her, and they never realize, oh, that's possible. They never put those two things together in their mind.
Well, first of all, comedy is very male-dominated, just in general.
Why is that?
You tell me. I don't know. It's basically lots of guys. There's very few women, and of that, there's even fewer Middle Eastern women. I will say one thing. Professor Bellici brought up something. He said that because you feel superior, you laugh at the jokes. You feel superior to the person that's on stage. May I tell you, the Middle Easterns, particularly Iranians, don't like to be made fun of. Every Iranian thinks they're superior to everyone else. Everything comes from Iranian culture.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, and plus the fact that Persia was invaded by everyone. Let's put it like that. We were conquered over and over and over again.
Even though Alexander defeated us.
Yeah, right.
We conquered them with our culture. So when I get up on stage and I make these jokes, Persia says, why you didn't find that funny?
Hmm.
You say Persian have the big nose. You say you're hairy. I'm like, but this is all true. There's nothing. I mean, these are not lies. No, I did not find it funny. And then I find out they just came from Iran. Once you've been in the American culture a little bit, you realize that the way to make people laugh is to make fun of yourself, and that's what I do. I make fun of the culture.
Yeah.
I make fun of the things that I'm up against, just as a female, just as a hairy female, you know, in a culture that's very hair phobic. You know, what do you do with that? And so, and then you go from there. I mean, it opens up a lot of doors, like Mike was saying. You get to meet a lot of different people, but you also have people in your own community that are very critical of you and judgmental.
Yeah.
As a woman particular.
You know, the funny thing is it happened to me, and it's, I kind of blame American media, and I never cast stones, but when I was going to Amman Comedy Festival, I was on a plane, me and two other comedians were flying there, and it was during the Hajj. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Hajj, of course, you guys in the back are. It's the pilgrimage for the Muslim. Okay, it didn't dawn on me, right? I'm going there to Amman for a show. And I'm sitting there, and next thing you know, I'm in the rolls with people, and I start seeing, like, people on my row doing this, and you know, at the same time, like, why are they doing Macarena? You know, it was freaking me out. I didn't know what was happening. And then one guy gets up, because I guess they have, Muslim culture, you have to wash before you pray. And one guy gets up and looks at the other guy, and he's, you know, he's going like this. He does that, just baseball signs, and I shit my pants. I literally was like, fuck, it's going down. Should I tackle this guy? Should I? I'm free. And the Nigerian guy sitting next to me, he goes, don't worry, he has to go wash before that. I go, oh, yeah, I knew it. And you see what I'm saying? So even I, you know, I forgot. So that's the good thing about this whole movement that's happening now. I got to remind, I help remind myself, I help remind other Middle Easterners who aren't Muslim, you know? In the audience about the Islamophobe, which I didn't know was I just heard about this for the first time. I was like, is there a pill for that? I didn't even know it existed. But I guess there is. I think to change people's minds, you have to touch their heart first, and that's the great way, you know, that's the great thing about the arts. And Mark Maron, this comedian I know, he said the best thing that I didn't really think about. He goes, you know, I wish more comedians would realize the tool that they're given. Because a lot of them go on stage and he says, play it safe, for better lack of, you know, words. He's like, you have an opportunity to be a modern-day Aristotle, Socrates. You have that tool, and most of them aren't using it. He says, why? So he says, I want to see more of that. And I was like, there's little, you know, some people creep in every now and then.
Most of the time, you know your audience, and you know where the line is, but what are the lines that you could cross?
The line is whatever society you're performing for. Like, I didn't realize when I went to Dubai, I did a private event there once, and for some reason it was no holds barred. You could say anything, talk about anything. When I did a public event, which was on television, you could talk about religion, but you can't talk about Muslim religion. You could talk about drinking, but you can't talk about smoking cigarettes. I was like, well, everybody here smokes. Why is it? It was a weird thing. So I had to understand what their culture is about. But I kind of teetered the line. I was flirting with it to see, if you can get away with it. And then when I went backstage, it all depends. I did cross the line on a couple of aspects, but nobody backstage chastised me because if you do it in a funny way, it blows right past people. They don't catch it. And Russell Peters said this once. He goes, I never edit myself. He goes, if I'm saying a story and they're saying, oh, if I play this region, don't cuss at all. He said, I'll tell a story. And I'll say, can you believe the fucking guy said that? I said, how did you get away with it? He goes, well, the story was so funny that they didn't catch that. They weren't listening for that word. You see what I'm saying? So he said, you can get away with it. He said, the only thing offensive to him, and I agree, is if it's not funny. If you're going to sit there and cuss and talk about taboo subjects and it's not funny, of course you're going to offend people. But if it's hilarious, ironically, something happens to the brain where people just doesn't register. So that's what I mean by line. Any line is a line. It depends on what region you're playing. And it's everybody has a different line.
The part about the structure versus the emotions. You know, a structure versus... I think comedy is in the second category, obviously. It's the breaking the structures. So whether it's racism, whether it's Iranians being better than others, whether it's the caste society, whether it's taboos, you know, pretty much comedy fights the structure. So, I mean, of course, it's good if you use it against racism, but typically it breaks down the structure. So I guess that's the nature of it. That's the shocking aspect of it. And
I think comedy sometimes, too, is comedians basically up there, and we make things... We tell our point of views and observations about things that all of us have in society that a lot of people can't say because they don't have the access or the medium. They're not on stage, and then we say also in a funny way. So we describe the things that are happening in day-to-day life, whether it be, you know, taking kids to school or a job or an oppressive regime, whatever it may be, but in a funny way that other people can't say, we can say it for them. You know, sometimes we make it relatable so they understand, hey, we understand this is what's funny about it, and let's bring this out in the open because everybody else can't talk about it.
People really listen to your point of view if you inject humor. Like, you're in college, you go to classes, and the professors you really get something out of their class is the ones that are kind of injecting humor. You'll be apt to listen more, as opposed to somebody who's just the whole class is da 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 and they're just going by rote. You're not really gonna get their. You're not gonna get the lesson of the day. You know what I mean? So you'll listen a little bit more with a little bit of humor or something you can relate to in that.
Thank you for listening to Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East. Please support the programs of Levantine Cultural Center with your contributions. Visit levantinecenter.org to learn more about how you can become involved. Radio Tabule produced by Jordan Elgrobli, Jen Reinhart, and Frida Becker, with music from Omar Fidel, omarfidel.com.